system working.
Ari Berman, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Senior writer at Mother Jones, author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Again, go to democracynow.org for the live streaming of the entire Amy Coney Barrett hearings. And a very happy birthday to our audio engineer, Miguel Noguera, and a happy first birthday to Quentin Warrenoff Rowley. That does it for our broadcast. Again, democracynow.org is the site for our daily grassroots global election show and the live stream of the Supreme Court hearings. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarsena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, and Adriana Contreras, our general manager. Special thanks to Julie Crosby and to Becca Staley, Miriam Barnard. I'm Amy Goodman. With Juan Gonzalez, stay safe, wear a mask, save lives.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kabu.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KABU, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available at our website. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kabu.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 8 a.m. on Tuesday. It's time for Too Much Information with your hosts, Abe and Tracy. Stay tuned.
Got to be a joker.
Hey, good morning, good morning, good morning. Welcome to Too Much Information on KBOO 90.7 FM. My name is Abe Proctor, and sitting across a video screen from me is my illustrious co-host, Tracy Simmons. Good morning, Tracy.
Good morning, Amy. Good morning, listeners.
We once again, as talk show hosts, find ourselves at a literal buffet table of possible topics in this, our Twilight Republic. So if we seem a little bit all over the page today, it's probably because we are, just because there's so very, very much to talk about right at the moment. So let's jump right in to the big stuff. Yesterday saw the first full day of deliberations in the nomination hearings of Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett. carried out amidst a hail of coronavirus particles spewing from the mouth of Senator Mike Lee and others whom we know to be COVID-19 positive here at this hearing for the next justice of the Supreme Court. What did you think of this spectacle, Tracy?
Oh my gosh, to see these people with no masks still, possibly infecting each other, still, you know, ramming this thing through. It's a spectacle for sure. We know that this person has certain kinds of beliefs that they will bring for this. I mean, I think it's just a dog and pony show at this point. We know that they are going to ram this candidate or this nominee through. We are quite sure what her politics are, and we know some of the politics as described in some of the views that she has espoused in the past. Some of the talks she has given that have been more controversial. Some of the language that she used. So she referred to, the LGBTQ community as having a sexual preference. We know that's kind of outdated language for it's a choice to be gay. There's just all kinds of problems with the nominee. I was hoping that the Democrats would do something bold, like not show up, because it's really illegitimate by Republican standards that they're even trying to have this, you know, nomination hearing and push this person through with, you know, 20-something days to the election. But, you know, they're entertaining. They're crazy. So I don't know. I've been trying to, as much as possible, pay attention, but I can't help but to tune it out. And there's, of course, so much else going on, right?
Is there such a thing as legitimacy or illegitimacy when it comes to either the strategies or tactics employed by elected Republicans? It doesn't seem like there is. Right, here we are. I know we talk about the hypocrisy, and yes, it is galling. Yes, it's hard to wrap one's brain around, but really, it is what it is. We knew that they were hypocrites going into this. We knew that if this opportunity arose, they would be doing exactly what they're doing. I think to call them out on hypocrisy is useless. It's not going to change their behavior. There's no sense of honor or decency or respect for norms and institutions that we can appeal to there. There is simply now a rank opportunism and a grasping search for any sort of power they can latch onto. It's the hypocrisy in any decent human being, of course, you know, you're repulsed by it, but it's useless to bring it up in this context to these people because they just don't care. But it puts the Democrats, and I think by extension the American people, in an interesting position, because we have in this nominee essentially a religious extremist, an ideologue, someone who is committed to some pretty archaic patriarchal Judeo-Christian values and conceptions of how family and gender dynamics ought to work and that sort of thing. And of course, the thing that's important to conservatives above all, they have a nominee whom they know will vote to overturn Roe versus Wade when that opportunity comes along. And I think it's a given once she takes her seat on the court, and we should stop fooling ourselves that anything different is going to happen. She will take her seat on the court, and this opportunity will come around. Now, this is something that our traditional adherence to separation of church and state, this is something where that would come into play. There is a statute on the books that requires federal justices at the Supreme Court and below to recuse themselves from making decisions in cases where they have a clear conflict of interest, where any reasonable person might conclude that they have a conflict of interest. And that is exactly what we have here. Now, the irony that I was alluding at a few minutes ago is that it's virtually impossible in the current political climate for anybody, let alone a Democratic senator sitting on the Judiciary Committee, to call Judge Coney Barrett out on anything, any stance she has related to her faith. That will automatically cross the other side to circle the wagons. She's essentially immune from criticism on this issue that is of the utmost importance to the future of the court and to the future of half of the United States and its ability to have autonomy over their own body. That's what we're talking about. Yet, this line of inquiry is essentially not open to us. It makes me wonder, though, if Judge Coney Barrett were Muslim and were dedicated to an archaic conception of the Islam's version of traditional patriarchal family and gender relations, if she was committed to bringing about the kingdom of God as a Muslim, I think somehow, suddenly, a religious line of inquiry would become open in this situation. Yeah. It's maddening.
Well, I mean, there's the whole anti-Catholicism, kind of angle that people have been trying to to, you know, address. And it's like, no, the Democratic nominee for president is a practicing faithful Catholic who goes to Mass every weekend, probably multiple times a week. I'm not sure. But, you know, the whole idea that, you know, liberals don't like Jesus and are anti-Christian, it's a non-starter. Right, but when we know that someone's faith, because of how deeply they sit in their faith, is going to impact the decisions that they are going to make, and make for a lot of people, there is every reason that we should ask those kinds of questions. Also, even recusing herself from, say, the election results, which she's already given some sense that she has no plans to do that. And so we know what's going on here. It feels like very much a transactional space where Trump has found the person who will sign off on his election if he so is in the right position to seal it, and then we'll continue on with the potential repeal of the ACA. And of course, you know, people are saying they're pro-life. I would say they're anti-choice and moving towards the anti-choice movement on Roe. And so, you know, I feel like we're at this point where everything is being revealed to us. If the Republicans had good ideas, and they thought that it was going to be the right thing, why wouldn't they want people to vote, right? We see massive voter suppression. We see lots of rumbling about the fact that there might be a contested election. And Amy Coney Barrett is the way to do that. And so it's right in front of our faces. At some point, we have to say, why is this still happening? Why are these people still in office? And what is off the table at this point? Is there anything that they won't do to continue to try and hold on to any last vestiges of power?
I think the answer is no. And we've already seen Judge Barrett's patron, Donald Trump, say the quiet part out loud once again. He's established the quid pro quo. And he needs to appoint a judge that can immediately rule on any possible dispute in the upcoming election. So he's already viewing this appointment as a way to ensure his own continuation of power. It's one of the most bald-faced and naked exercises of raw political power that I can recall in my lifetime. And maybe I'm being a little hyperbolic. Maybe we have some listeners who can call up and set me straight. But I don't recall it ever being quite this shameless, quite this grasping, quite this Machiavellian from them. but here's one thing might be going on. So 538.com, Nate Silver's statistics shop, is someplace I keep an eye on. I know you're not a big fan of polls, Tracy, so bear with me for just a moment here. I also see polls as having limited utility. They do give you a snapshot of where certain groups of voters are at a given moment on a given subject. Now, that's helpful about as far as you can carry it. But it does help us to give some idea of how the mind of the electorate is shaping up. So 538 ran their simulation of the election 40,000 times to see who wins the most often. In those 40,000 simulations, Joe Biden wins the White House 87 out of 100 times, Trump 13 out of 100 times. So I think what's happening and what we're seeing manifesting in these SCOTUS hearings is that most of the elected Republican establishment was reading the writing on the wall. They look at statistics like this and they see Trump losing the upcoming election. And what's more, they see a possible wave election developing. They see losing control of the Senate. They see the Democrats increasing their lead in the House. And so they realize that Trump's coattails are no longer enough. So they're beginning the process of distancing. And this process is made a little bit more difficult by the fact that they have so firmly attached themselves to his butt cheeks like so many elected lampreys. But they are beginning the process of distancing. And here's what I think is going on. They see all of a sudden that the Supreme Court seat has dropped out of the sky into their hands, and they have control of the Senate, and they are absolutely going to confirm her come hell or high water, because they know it's their last grasp at the brass wing, because pretty soon they're not going to be in power anymore. So what they're going to do is they're going to seat her in the Supreme Court. They're going to trash the place on their way out the door. They're going to opportunistically pass whatever conservative legislation they're able, although it must be noted that the current Congress doesn't, you know, actually legislate very often. They're going to do this. They're going to trash the place going out the door, and then they're going to switch over into anti-deficit phobia and go into full austerity mode just in time for a Joe Biden presidency so they can oppose every one of his progressive initiatives on the grounds that it's just too expensive. That's what I think is happening.
I mean, I think you have a really good idea there. I think there is also the alternative counterpoint that you know, they might all be ready to just continue stealing elections. We know that there's definitely some misdealings that were happening in the 2016 election. We know that there was likely something like that happened in 2018 to give, you know, Governor Ron DeSantis the win, to give Governor Brian Kemp the win in Georgia. We are aware that there are reports that there was currently a meddling effort going on by Russia and other countries. And so, you know, I think they might know they're going to lose, but they might also think that there's an opportunity to win here if they just continue playing the game with Trump. And so I'm hoping that you're right about the first, because I can't do another 4 years of Trump. I know a lot of people who just really couldn't take that. But what you're saying is likely and scary, because we know what this looks like, right? Blocking every opportunity to move anything forward, and continuing to deepen, you know, actual people, the voter, the electorate, ideas that voting even counts, right? When you continue mm-hmm. to vote with your conscience and vote for the people that you want, but when they get into office, they are handcuffed by the rest of the people who absolutely do nothing and have no desires to actually pass legislation, that we just get in this kind of stalemate where it just deepens people's resentment and feelings that voting doesn't count anyway. Nothing's going to happen. Nothing's ever going to change. And so, I mean, I think there are some critical pieces that need to move. Like, we have to get rid of the Electoral College. It is the last vestige of slavery that we really have that has such an impact on our lives and the reality of voting. We have to enact some voting rights measures. You know, we have the Voting Rights Act that was basically slashed. We have Citizens United. We have some of these huge overarching legislative mandates that make it really hard for people to vote. And of course, right now, the Republicans are doing everything to stop people from voting. But I think if we could potentially get in power long enough to address those things, we could actually move some things forward as far as progressive legislation.
Yeah, I think there's some reasons to be optimistic on that front. Although a lot of longtime listeners to this show are pretty cynical about the ability or even the desire of the Democratic Party to enact progressive legislation at the national level. And I must confess, I share that cynicism to a large degree. However, there have been some developments in recent years that lead me to believe that maybe an actual progressive legislating Congress is something we might have in the not-too-distant future. And I'm talking about the rise of people to prominence like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and like Ilhan Omar and Ayanna Pressley and a lot of the folks that were swept into Congress in the last election. Those people, I think, are the future of progressive politics in this country. And the fact that they happen to be Democrats should not give us pause here in far-off Portland. As a matter of fact, I think it should give us hope.
Yeah, I agree. I'm hopeful. I am an optimist. At the end of the day, I'm an optimist. And I think that there's so much potential for having people in this age range leading, you know, with politics that are for the people. Because what we've seen is we have a very small group of older folks who, you know, futures are not wrapped up in the decisions they make today. The rest of our futures are wrapped up in it. And so if we could get more people who are representative of the actual makeup of the nation, more people who are representative of the age demographic of the nation, mm-hmm. But we have to get money out of politics. I mean, I could just say for the people that I know who are upcoming in politics, the the challenge to get, you know, funded for a campaign and be able to be elected is a huge barrier for a younger person that is a regular person, right, that doesn't have Ted Wheeler money or, you know, Donald Trump money in their pocket, or the influence of laundered Russian money in their pocket to be able to buy an election. And so, you know, if we want that and we want to see that, we want to see more progressive politics play out, we have to be able to allow people an equal opportunity, at least, to become elected, because the money in the campaigns is really causing the similar situation that we're seeing at the national scale with an oligarchy, right? People who have the money buy the elections, they buy the endorsements, and then they get elected, and then they enact not progressive policies toward getting more money, right? And a real capitalist kind of construct. And so we've got to get money out of politics if we would like to see more of these kinds of progressive leaders really take the mantle and run with it towards enacting policies for all Americans to be able to prosper and live out that American dream.
That was very well said. Very well said. And I want to follow that up with just an example of how pernicious the effect of money in politics has become. I have a friend here in Portland who a few years ago was exploring the prospect of running for a seat on the Portland Public Schools board. And he was informed by someone in a position to know such things that he would need at least $50,000, preferably closer to $100,000, to wage a credible campaign in that race. That's for a school board in Portland, Oregon. And one can only imagine the sums being thrown around at the highest level. It really, the distorting effect that moneyed interests have on the mechanisms of our democracy really can't be overstated. In fact, anyone, you know, time warping in to 2020 from a more sedate, more staid period in our past, let's say, you know, from one of the two or three decades after the Second World War, I think would be astonished to look at what has happened to our political system and the distortion that moneyed interests have been able to bring to bear on it. It's led to declining confidence in our norms and our institutions. And it sounds, when you say that, oh, Donald Trump has had such a deleterious effect on respect for the norms and institutions with which our republic does this. It sounds like not a very big deal. Well, norms, whatever. You know, we needed someone to come in and shake up the norms. Well, this sort of unspoken common agreement on what representative government looks like and how it works governs all of the interactions that take place at that level. There's an understanding about how people ought to behave when they have their common interests at heart, when they are participating members of a representative democracy. And that's what we mean when we talk about the undermining of norms and institutions, the loss of touch with those guiding principles that have kept the ship of state more or less on course. Yes, and I know there's a lot of room here at the margins to poke holes in my argument. Absolutely. But I think what I'm saying is broadly true.
Yeah.
Well, let's go ahead.
Oh, I don't disagree. I mean, I feel like the norms were breaking way before Trump. I feel like we give Trump too much credit, right? We talk about Trump like, you know, he's just this master, you know, mind, and he's got, no, I think he's being manipulated by people who broke the norms a long time ago. So when we talk about the Mitch McConnells of the world and, you know, other folks who are really pulling the strings of Donald Trump, most of the people within his orbit at this point are pulling the strings and have been. The iterations of people who have come and gone have been pulling the strings. He is not that smart, but absolutely is the figurehead for the moment. And
all right,
that once he goes away and they're still there, they will blame him as opposed to take their own responsibility and stand in their own guilt for the things that they have done.
Yeah, he's this racist maniac that totally took over our entire party and we all kissed his ring, but now we're going to blame him.
Yep.
Turn around and blame him for this. All right, this is Too Much Information on KVOO 90.7 FM. 503-231-8187 is the number to call if you'd like to take part in this conversation, and we sincerely hope that you do. I also have a little bit of information to share. We now have a Twitter account that is dedicated to the show. It is at TMIPDX2. That's the number two, at TMIPDX2. And right now, it is an unsullied, absolutely pure Twitter account. And I would love for someone to send us our first tweet and just sully the heck out of that stuff. At TMIPDX2 is the Twitter account. And that is dedicated just to the show, and both Tracy and I have access to that. So let's go to the phones. Robbie, good morning.
Yeah, good morning.
What's on your mind?
Good morning.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry about that. So I was, I was trying to listen through the phone. I couldn't quite hear the last part that you were saying, but the money and politics thing is really, I don't even think we were talking about the squad earlier. I was really happy when, AOC was, won her election. I don't know. The problem that I'm seeing, though, is that now they're in the system. And I don't know if many people are aware of this, but Ilhan Omar was very, very vocal and adamant in combating the Iranian sanctions. Do you know what I'm talking about? You know what I'm about to bring up?
Yeah, but tell us a little bit more.
So basically last year, times were getting a little tense with Iran, and when COVID happened, the American government started passing all sorts of sanctions against Iran, which was literally starving the people there. And Ilhan Omar was a huge vocal candidate, one of the few people that was just raising a fuss, not voting for the sanctions. She was not participating in that. And it was a very weird moment, but right around February or March was when she was extremely against these Iranian sanctions. At some point, right after COVID happened, like after March, she then just decided to vote for it. And a very weird and strange occurrence happened because AOC had went on Twitter and put out this whole long thing about how Ilhan Omar is a very, how we should listen to her and she's a great person. And I really do think she is. But what I saw happening under the thing, I always kind of view the world like there's the surface level and then there's what's actually happening. And what I saw happening at that time was the Democratic Party, particular the squad, they started standing down. This was right around the time that Bernie Sanders, everybody kind of came out against Bernie Sanders. Obama was, had a talk, tried getting Bernie Sanders to pull out. All this was going on at the same time, and Ilhan Omar ended up going back, totally backtracked on her Iranian sanctions view, and then voted for Trump's Iranian sanctions. And so the thing that's scary to me is like when we play this, oh, we got the squad in, oh, we can just vote, that's not enough. And that's the only reason why I'm so adamant about being against Joe Biden is because, yeah, you know what, if you want to vote for Joe Biden, fine, but I don't think that's enough. I think that what it kind of does is it creates the dangerous thing about voting is that there's going to be a lot of people who get Joe Biden and then they're like, oh, okay, great, we're done. And the truth is I've been an activist since Obama with Dakota Access Pipeline, Black Lives Matter, the first one, Occupy Wall Street, all was under a Biden and Obama's administration. And so that's why I see this playing this political game is kind of dangerous, is when we're not paying attention to what they're actually doing and we get caught up in the identity politics and the left and right football game, political sports show,
Yeah, I think you're bringing up something that we must understand as progressives in the context of this election, that the temptation, to rally behind Joe Biden simply to get rid of Donald Trump is overwhelming, and it's something we absolutely have to do. It's a moral, political, economic, social, public health imperative point. But what we can't lose sight of, and I think that what you're putting your finger on here quite well, is that, what passed for normalcy was not enough. Things were already flying off the handle even before Donald Trump entered the scene. Normal is nowhere near good enough. We need to push for something much, much more. And I think I share your concern in this when I say that I worry that a Biden administration is going to be a little too corporate-friendly, centrist Democratic Party business as usual than we need it to be. And it's going to require the absolute unrelenting pressure from those of us on the left to make sure that he steers this country in the right direction. And, you know, I'm not convinced that we'll be able to do it. But nonetheless, here we are. We have to try.
I think the, the other part is that Biden has pretty much expressed that he's a one-term president. He doesn't plan to be a two-term president at this point, and basically said he would like to turn over the, you know, levers of power to the younger generations. And so I take that as an invitation. I take that as a imperative to continue pushing and fighting and you know, expressing my will over what's happening, and as much as possible mobilizing other people to do the same, because we will have another opportunity in about 4 years if Biden is elected. Who knows what happens if Trump is elected? And so that's why I can't do the protest vote in this election. I just it doesn't make sense for me. It doesn't make sense for my family. And so I'm making a choice.
Well, here's
with the future in mind.
If I might mention, like, the thing that, you know, you brought up with, we have to get rid of the Electoral College. First and foremost, our votes don't count. The popular vote is never, which is what's considered. And if we're in a blue state, basically our entire state votes for whatever Electoral College, you know, our state's going to vote for. And so being in a blue state, it's not throwing away a vote to vote third party. You're actually voting for a third party. The only way to vote for Trump is if you're voting for Trump. If you don't vote for Trump, you're not voting for Trump. And the idea that we have this toxic political game where people are now like shaming each other, it's like the thing that people need to realize, and I didn't understand this when I first witnessed Al Gore versus Bush, where the popular vote was, you know, not a big deal, you know. Obviously, you know, the Supreme Court also rigged it, but Florida, when you play this Electoral College game, the thing that we need to realize is that it's not when you're like the people who voted third party. Like, I remember I was really young and I was like, whoa, why did Ralph Nader run? If Ralph Nader, in my mind was, if Ralph Nader didn't run, those people would have voted for Al Gore. I was wrong. Those people wouldn't have voted, because there's not a standing moral president. And I think if the Democrats had a bit of a backbone after they rigged the primary election and we said, you know what, we're not going to support this establishment candidate who's going to hand it off to another establishment Kamala Harris, who, you know, honestly, when I was watching those debates, was lying. She's just a better liar. She was saying that she went after the housing, you know, the people who did the housing crisis market. And that's total. That was a total lie. And so I don't see how we can't be just a little bit more aware and hold our politicians to a higher standard. I think when we play this left and right political game, we allow them, and we're actually enabling the Democratic Party to continue to do this. They've been doing this since 1968.
I don't dispute. Hey, look, I'm going to just jump in here because we're going to need to move on to others here pretty soon. I don't dispute what you're saying. The binary nature of our electoral system forces us, in combination with this archaic electoral college system, forces us to do the sort of electoral calculus that you're doing. You're saying to yourself, I live in Oregon, which is reliably blue, so I can afford to cast my vote for a third party, and it's not going to affect the outcome of an election. You know, first of all, I think that we should collectively reject any situation that brings to bear those sort of calculations. You should not have to think like that when you're deciding who to vote for president of the United States. But at the same time, you know, you can make that decision because you have that luxury. You have that privilege of living in a reliably blue state. But, you know, what if you're a progressive living in Wisconsin or in Ohio or in Michigan or in Florida? You can't do that. You don't have the privilege or the luxury of voting for the person you really like because you feel you have to wield your vote defensively. And, you know, and that's galling on almost every level. But there it is. There's the system that we have. You know, so I admire your optimism, and I admire your commitment to principle. But I would say, you know, maybe spare a thought for those people who don't live in the same state of privilege that you do, with regard to how
everybody listening to this is in Oregon, and for that part, you know, we are not in the swing state. So I feel that we are the people to hold the Democratic Party a little bit more accountable.
I can come
perhaps. All right. Well, thank you very much for the call. Appreciate it. Robbie's comments are always provocative, and they don't let us rest on our laurels, Tracy. And I both admire that and am really annoyed by that. So thank you.
I appreciate
you for the call, Robbie. do you have anything to say on that situation?
I mean, I get what he's saying. I also have family in Ohio. I have family in Texas. I have family and my best friend since fifth grade in Florida. And so I'm having to have conversations with people whose votes absolutely do count. And they do count more than ours, unfortunately, because of the Electoral College. And that's why I say we need to get rid of the Electoral College. We need to make sure that we say that everyone's vote counts, and it's not true. People in certain states votes count more than mine, more than yours, more than anybody in Oregon. And that does not seem fair. It does not encourage people to vote. And so it is another voter suppression tactic. And so I'm looking at everything through the lens of voter suppression, whether we talk about in Texas the fact that there will only be one voter ballot drop box per county. And we have counties in Texas that have, you know, thousands of people versus counties in Texas that have millions of people. You do the math. It's inequitable. Mm-hmm. It's unequal. It is, you know, going to have an impact on this election in a place that is a swing state and does have a ton of electoral votes attached to it. So we have to really be thinking more broadly about our own ability to cast our ballot and think about our other, you know, friends and family in other places who, you know, their vote absolutely does matter and can swing this election one way or the other. For the purpose of using my, you know, influence and sharing with people, I'm just going to continue to tell people to vote, and hopefully they will make a good choice. But I think we have a responsibility outside of our disillusionment with the Democratic Party to move whatever way we can towards that progressive you know, North Star as incrementally as possible, even if it takes a long time. We can't allow it to go backwards. And even allowing it to go backwards or saying like, oh, well, Trump gets another election, it won't matter to me, is really speaking that into existence, one. And two, it's also not true, right? It might not have a huge impact on you personally, but it will have an impact on other people. And so I'm always thinking about the other people, the people with less power than me, the people with, you know, less privilege, the people with less ability to, you know, kind of ask for what they want and demand what they need from this coming administration, whoever it is.
Speaking of voter suppression, this just in out of Virginia, according to television station WUSA, quote, an accidentally cut cable has caused the entire Virginia voter registration system to go down on the last day to register to vote before Election Day. Well.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
503-231-8187 is the number to call. If you're listening to Too Much Information on KBOO 90.7 FM, let's go to Dennis. Good morning.
Hello. Yes. Thank you for taking my call. Can you hear me?
Certainly.
Yes. Hi, Dennis.
Okay. Okay. A different topic. What I learned on the previous show, Democracy Now!, is that the Republican Party of California is trying to install rigged drop boxes so that if people I don't know if you have you heard about this that
if, yes so if they've people, admitted to it.
But if people put their vote in there, ballots in there, they won't count. So that's all. I mean, just I don't know whether it's out there, whether you've heard of it or what. But it should be noted. I mean, for your California friends, that's what's happening down there. Good God, that's awful. I'm calling from Portland, but anyway, that's all I have to say. Thank you very much, and I'll take my comment off the air. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. Yes, this from the New York Times. The California Republican Party has admitted responsibility for placing more than 50 deceptively labeled official drop boxes for mail-in ballots in Los Angeles, Fresno, and Orange counties, an action that state officials said is illegal and could lead to voter fraud. Here, put your ballot in one of our boxes. Trust us. Trust us. We'll make sure it gets to where it needs to go. And by that, I mean tossed into the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course, you know, who's going to be tricked by that, right? People who are not, you know, super news savvy, people who are not checking the, you know, the feeds on social media on a regular basis. Those are the people who are going to be subject to potentially having their vote not counted, because who knows what's happening with those votes. I wonder also, you know, and I know in some states, the outside of the ballot is marked based on your political affiliation. And so I'm hoping that is not the case, that someone could just, you know, do a simple sort of the ballot and decide whose vote they're going to submit to, you know, the elections officials, and whose vote that they're not going to submit. I would be really, really cautious in California about dropping my ballot in any box right now. And that's also the mechanism, right? Trying to get people to feel like their vote has been undermined or the election has been undermined. So then you have questions about who actually won. I mean, the whole idea of Trump spewing his nonsense for months about, you know, fraud and voter fraud and, you know, mail-in fraud and all of this stuff is to sow, you know, misinformation, but also, you know, kind of get people really thinking, is this the right outcome? Is this the truth? And he's been, you know, on a tirade against the truth from the moment he got into office. But this, you know, really sets up this conversation about norms once again, that the norm has been that we accept the results, but by sowing this kind of discord and this mistrust in the electoral process, we begin to think, well, shoot, you know, I can't even get my, you know, my ballot in the right box. I don't know what box to put it in. In Texas and you know, Georgia, there are people standing in lines for 10, 11 hours to vote. It just creates more and more of a question mark about why we are making it so hard to vote. And I say we with air quotes. And if you had good policies, you'd want people to vote for them, right?
Right. And if people aren't voting for you, then perhaps it's time to re-examine your policies. But no, that's not what they do. Instead of re-examining their policies and perhaps coming up with a worldview that's more broadly palatable to Americans, they try to make sure that the wrong people aren't able to vote. And I'm sure you know who I mean, Tracy, when I say the wrong people. this makes me so angry. There's a saying about conservatism that's been out there for a long time, and it goes something like this. Conservatism cannot fail. It can only be failed. And I think voter suppression is an outgrowth of this underlying ideology that says we have this set of worldviews and beliefs that we believe will universally lead to the best possible of all worlds. And therefore, if policy positions tied to those beliefs are not successful at the polls, we just need to make sure that they are successful at the polls, not by coming forth with different ideas, different policies, even different beliefs. No, we're just going to make sure that we're able to dominate and control who is able to go to the polls and who isn't. That is not the ideology of someone who believes in representative democracy. That is the ideology of autocracy, of dictatorship, of even totalitarianism. It's frightening. It's frightening to see that sort of single-minded devotion. It's frightening to see that absolute disdain for the democratic process. We are in a tight spot, my fellow Americans. That's what I really want to impress upon you through this program in these final weeks leading up to the election. Not only do we have to make sure that we get our votes in here in Oregon, and thanks to Trump's attacks on the Postal Service and its efficacy, we no longer have the same sense of security in our elections that we've enjoyed for the past 20 years. In fact, I myself am planning to take my ballot and walk it down to an official, not a fake, ballot drop box, because I'm not entirely confident in the ability of the Postal Service to deliver my vote. That is a choice that each voter must make. But I'm saying to you that if you know for a fact that the President of the United States and his political party have actively worked to undermine the very mechanism that ensures you are able to vote in Oregon, you might want to make a contingency plan yourself.
I personally, because we don't have, you know, going to the polls, I've always driven mine to my ballot drop box, and, you know, it's made me feel like I was doing my civic duty, and I will continue doing that. I have never mailed a ballot in Oregon since I've lived in Oregon. And it's just because I don't buy stamps and I don't have postage hanging around. So there's that.
Right.
Which now I want to just go buy a whole bunch of stamps and try and keep the, you know, postal service afloat. I haven't done it yet, though.
I should be careful here. I don't want my words to, you know, indicate a broad distrust of the Postal Service and what it does. I think the Postal Service is a wonderful thing, a great public service, and considering what they're able to do for a relatively small amount of money every single day, it's pretty incredible. But when the ruling political party is working actively to undermine that service in the weeks and months leading up to an election that's going to depend more than ever before on ballots arriving by mail, what I'm saying is, if you want to be absolutely positively sure, you should take that ballot and put it in the drop box. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I agree.
Yes. And if you're looking for a Dropbox location, thank you, Engineer Sonia, for putting this up for us. You can visit www.multco.us/dropsites. Multco.us/dropsites. And that'll give you a list of ballot drop sites in Multnomah County. Let's go back to the phones. Marcos, good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to counter the previous caller who was talking third party, essentially denouncing the lack of difference between Democrats and Republicans, and talking about the Electoral College, and essentially that we could take Oregon's vote for granted, that Oregon will vote blue, and so now we can vote third party. Noam Chomsky has recently spoken out against that, and he has encouraged in the past third-party voting for states such as Oregon, which are reliably blue. This is a time when it's absolutely essential to vote decisively Donald Trump out of office with the popular vote. The more decisive that vote is, the less room for shenanigans to in any way be accepted. This is an existential moment in our history. Four more years of Donald Trump will mean game over. I don't like anything about Biden. I don't like anything about Kamala Harris, except they're not Donald Trump. The idea of working against a Biden-Harris administration to push for progressive causes is at least a possibility. There is no opportunity. There's no room to push a Trump regime. That will be, I don't like to use the word fascism too often, but it'll be a total breakdown of democracy. And Biden-Harris, same old, same old, will at least give us some room, will at least give us some breathing space, whereas a Trump regime for the next 4 years will be catastrophic. So the idea of somehow voting your principles by voting for a third candidate just to make a point is suicidal. Thank you.
Thanks, Sam.
Yeah, Tracy, you want to take a stab at that?
I mean, he said it. I really am just going to say, for me, I cannot possibly vote a third party. So I absolutely agree. It is an existential moment for us as a nation. And to rethinking about our future, there's a path to the future through Biden-Harris, right? When I think about incremental politics, moving incrementally towards the future that you want, the potential for that with Trump in office for another 4 years is just not even an opportunity, not even a possibility. We've seen where this is going. We know where this goes. This person thinks of themselves as a king, referenced in today's show. What we've set that up, you know, had got really sick with the virus, told everyone he's not sick, had a plan to come out with a Superman shirt under his blue suit, his very oversized and untailored blue suit, to show that he's, you know, completely healthy and not at all infected. This person, we cannot afford an America with 4 more years of Trump. And so I do feel like the 2020 is a referendum on Trump. We got to get rid of him. And if it's, you know, Biden, I'm voting. If it would have been Pete Buttigieg, I'd vote for him. If it would have been, you know, anybody, really.
Putin might be a better choice, too. I don't know.
I mean, you know, go right to the source, I guess. But so I'm right there with the caller. I have absolutely heard people saying they're going to, you know, put right in Yeezy or right in Kanye or right in whoever. And I'm like, well, you go ahead with that. But for the rest of us, we have to be very serious about the moment and meet the moment with our vote.
Yeah, I agree. That's well said. Let's go to Lynn, who's standing by on the phone. She has some important info about mailing in your ballots. Lynn, good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to say that in Oregon, you don't need a stamp to mail in your ballot. We used to, but that was remedied. And I always considered it like a poll tax. So I was elated when our legislature changed that. So I just wanted people to know that, and that they won't be discouraged on some level if they think they have to put a stamp on it, because not in Oregon.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, that's very good to know. And that's good on you, Oregon government, for doing that. I mean, let's
Absolutely.
Remove those burdens to voting. Let's make it as easy as possible. That's what we should be doing, mm-hmm. not making it more difficult.
Yeah.
Our engineer, Sonia, just whispered to me in the chat channel, settling for fairy tales of incremental progress has brought us nothing but incremental fascism. I would say that that's largely true, which I think just throws the problem with our system into starker relief, right? We should be able to affirm with our votes, you know, make a positive choice reflecting our values and feel good about that and not have to worry that in doing so, we're delivering the country into the hands of fascists. I mean, it's maddening. It's maddening that as progressives, every single time it seems like, we have to make this sort of decision. I know that our listeners are tired of it. I'm tired of it. I suspect, Tracy, that you're tired of it as well. But, you know, you go to the election with the system you have, not the one you wish you had.
I keep asking people, what is the alternative other than a civil war? And I am not ready to go to war. I am not, you know, a warrior. I would not win if it was on me to be fighting with other people. So outside of getting control and taking the opportunity to make change while you have control, I don't really know what is the alternative. Voting a third party for me is not the alternative.
No, nor for me. Yeah, but that leaves American progressives in the same dilemma that we find ourselves in all the time. And the answer, I think, and this, unfortunately, is the answer that we have to give every time this dilemma comes up, is that you vote for the person you don't like all that much, and then you resolve to apply pressure to that person throughout the duration of his or her term in office. And I don't know that we have any other... I would say that, yes, the country absolutely needs a viable third, fourth, and fifth political party, but the time to build those structures, the time to do that work is in the periods between elections. It's too late every 4 years for progressives to, you know, say everybody vote for the Green Party candidate. This will be the election when everybody, there's this massive come to Jesus moment, and we all decide we're not going to vote for either the Democrats or Republicans. That's not going to happen. That is never going to happen. If there's going to be any sort of alternative, it needs to be built from the ground up, and it needs to have been going on for a long time already. We're not in that world. We don't live in that world. And so here we are as progressives with a choice we're not particularly excited about. There it is. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. Have I brought you down, crashing down to earth, Tracy?
Absolutely not. I am an optimist. I will remain an optimist. And the work that I do is always about progress, always about moving forward. And I have a teeny bit of patience, and I use that patience to really be strategic in what I want to see and what I would like to do. And so I bring that same kind of energy into my kind of views with politics and my want to continue pushing and pushing and pushing. And outside of a revolutionary moment, I don't see that we're going to have another alternative to the slow trod towards what we would like to see in our future. And hopefully, we can make some big progress, because, I mean, I see some really big opportunities around the Electoral College, around, you know, even stacking the Supreme Court with a few or four or five more justices. I mean, we have some opportunities coming to us. We have to take those opportunities. And we must impress upon our Democratic leadership that we're going to accept nothing less.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it starts with some pretty simple and straightforward demands. We demand that the candidates for national office adopt the Sanders fundraising model. Individual donations only. No super PAC money, no PAC money, no corporate money. Just money from individual citizens. That ought to be the model we demand from every Democrat that runs for national office. That's how we finally break the grip of money on the political system, by demonstrating that you can win without having to go hat in hand to the biggest and most powerful moneyed interest in the land.
Mm-hmm. And be beholden to them once you get into office.
Yes, indeed. Yes. You always have to pay the piper, don't you? Eventually that bill comes due.
Yeah.
So you are listening to Too Much Information on KBOO 90.7 FM. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. We should let you know that neither Tracy nor I will be with you next week. There'll be some alternative programming in our place, but we will return to you the following week, at which point it will only be 1 week away from the election. let's see here.
So I heard one of our callers reference the debate, and what I didn't hear is him reference the fly on Mike Pence's head. What I was looking
at, I was wondering if we'd make through the show without talking about it. Go ahead.
He looked sick. He looked like he had the COVID. He looked like he had the Rona. His eyes looked kind of red. His face looked kind of green with a little bit of makeup fluffed on it. We are yet to hear about whether he's actually had it or not. But yeah, I was a little worried about that. The whole show was kind of a non-starter for me. It was pretty boring, but at least I wasn't traumatized when I finished watching it like I was with the Joe Biden-Trump debate. I don't know. I didn't think anyone came out a strong winner. I do feel like both sides kind of either fluffed around questions they didn't want to answer, or, you know, in the case of Mike Pence, was outright lying. I heard someone referenced that Kamala Harris was lying. I don't know. I didn't do the fact checking on that. I really was quite underwhelmed by the whole thing. And this begs the question, are we going to have more debates? We know that the next debate that was scheduled for the 15th has been canceled. What do you think, Abe? What are we looking forward to in the next run-up to this election?
Well, if I were advising Donald Trump, I would advise him to not take part in any more debates, to perhaps stop the bleeding any way I possibly could. He's so outmatched, even by a guy with as laid-back a demeanor as Joe Biden. I would not let him out on that debate stage with Joe Biden again. That said, we probably are going to have at least one more debate. When and where that will take place, I don't know. But as for the vice presidential debate, you really saw white male privilege on display there, didn't you? I mean, how many times did Mike Pence interrupt, talk over Kamala Harris over and over and over again? Even at one point demanding that she answer his questions rather than those of the moderator. I mean, it was if you wanted an object lesson in what a lot of women have to deal with, particularly women of color, in a professional setting, day after day after day, there it was on display for the entire country.
Yeah, that was rough. But
indeed it was. Let's go to Thomas. One more call before the end. Thomas, good morning.
Yeah, hi. I've got something positive here. I don't think it's come up on the show yet this morning, but we know that the Congress and the federal government is never going to get rid of the Electoral College. They just hardly do anything to improve the voting situation in this country, which is horribly corrupt for the supposedly the greatest democracy in the world. But there's a group called National Popular Vote that has gotten 15 states to agree to give their electoral votes to the person who wins the national popular vote, the most votes from the people. They will assign their votes to the winner of that national vote. So they need 270 electoral votes, but they have 196 already. So they only need a handful of states to get that difference between 196 and 270, and that'll totally, it won't get rid of the Electoral College, but it will nullify its effect. And I just think that's one of the most positive things that I've heard in a long time that the people in the states are doing to improve the effectiveness of our vote.
Yeah, thank you very much for the call. I'm really glad you brought that up. That's called the Interstate Popular Vote Compact. And it's really a brilliant end run around the Electoral College, because, of course, abolishing the Electoral College would require amending the Constitution, which requires a majority vote of three quarters of the state legislatures. It's a really heavy lift to amend the Constitution. And this would simply go around that by, you know, putting into place an agreement between a bunch of states. It's brilliant. It's easy. And I don't think there's any grounds to oppose it. Constitutionally, although I would imagine the new 6-3 conservative Supreme Court would certainly look for grounds to oppose it constitutionally. But it's a great idea.
It's hopeful, and it's coming to fruition in blue states. The states that don't want people to vote are never going to support something like that, because it relinquishes them from their power.
Indeed it does. And I think we're going to have to leave it there, as we've come to the end of the hour. Thank you, Tracy, once again.
Thanks, callers.
Absolutely. Thanks, everybody. Thank you for supporting the station during our membership drive. If you want to become a member, go to kboo.fm, click on the donate button. And with that, we will see you next week.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Makes you such a threat. We choose the right to be who we are. We know the difference between the reality of freedom and the illusion of freedom. There's a way to live with Earth and a way not to live with Earth.